This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Unfortunately, too many African countries are still reliant on the West for budget support, for purchasing capital equipment, for help with building roads, security as well in many cases.
That's Yo Nyako, an economics professor at New York University, on the areas where Brexit might affect African countries. Also, Botswana is preparing for elections next Wednesday as Mozambique continues to count ballots from its voting. We look at the fallout in Africa from Britain's exit from the EU, and Kenya is vaccinating girls for protection from a virus that can cause a cervical cancer. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's a lot more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour: election fever is mounting in Botswana as voters prepare to go to the polls on October 23rd. Former President Ian Khama has formed a breakaway party following policy differences with his hand-picked successor, President Mokgweetsi Masisi. And an opposition coalition also is campaigning to form a new government. From Harare, Botswana, Mukosi Dube has more.
Botswana, which enjoys relative peace and stability, is bracing for a crucial election on October 23. Botswana's fourth president, Ian Khama, is vigorously campaigning against his successor, President Mokgweetsi Masisi. The two former allies have clashed over policy differences, which led to Khama to quit the ruling Botswana Democratic Party, BDP, to form the Botswana Patriotic Front, BPF, in April. While the stakes are high, some voters are still undecided.
My final choice will be based on an individual, not the party. It's the most expensive one, an exciting one, and I'm really waiting for the day to come so that I'll see where my vote will go.
Khama's influence in the country's central district, a traditional stronghold of the ruling BDP, makes the election too close to call, says analyst Zibanani Maundeni.
It's for the first time that the BDP will be going into an election without a stronghold. And this brings a lot of uncertainty in our politics to the extent that it's difficult to predict what is going to happen.
While analysts predict a close contest, the main opposition party, the Umbrella for Democratic Change, UDC, is also campaigning hard to win on October 23rd. A coalition of three parties, it poses a major threat to the BDP, and its spokesperson, Mwedi Mohasa, says locals should prepare for a new government.
We have a split BDP. That gives us a chance, and we are hopeful that we will win this coming elections. People should brace themselves to a new government.
But BDP activist Murekolodi Moemeli says President Masisi is their trump card at the polls.
Botswana do have trust in Masisi's administration. Ever since he took office, I see so many changes. There'll be chances of losing some seats there, but all in all, I see Masisi winning.
Since assuming office, President Masisi has reversed most of Khama's signature policies, including relaxing alcohol trading hours, lifting a ban on trophy hunting, and restoring relations with China. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Harare, Botswana.
In Mozambique, vote counting continues amid allegations of rigging. The leader of the main opposition party, Renamo Asofo Momade, has warned he will not accept manipulated results, prompting fears that August peace accord with the government could be in jeopardy. Momade is reported to have shown journalists evidence of attempted fraud and declared his party would do whatever the people want them to. While praising election day as smooth, orderly and largely peaceful, the European Union decried violence in the run-up to the vote, murder, arson and obstruction of campaigns. The EU also questioned the integrity of the voters' register. The electoral administration has denied accusations of vote manipulation. Acceptance of the results is seen as a key test to a peace deal between the ruling Frelimo Party and its old Civil War IV-turned political rival Renamo. Official results are expected before the month's end. As the deadline for Brexit approaches and the United Kingdom prepares to leave the European Union, Africa's economies must also prepare. How will Brexit affect trade between Africa and the UK and between Africa and the European Union? What are its potential opportunities and pitfalls for Africa's farmers? And how will it affect African migrants overseas? VOA's Adam Phillips interviewed Ya Nyako, a Ghana-born professor of economics at New York University and the director of the Center for Technology and Development, with branches in New York and Accra. Nyako began with the critical issue of foreign aid.
Unfortunately, too many African countries are still reliant on the West for budget support, for purchasing capital equipment, for help with building roads, security as well in many cases. And so if you ask the person on the street how the average person is impacted by all of these things, the channel is primarily foreign aid.
So does the UK's membership or non-membership in the EU affect African aid?
There is a sort of a cultural bias within the EU, which is a bit more supportive of quote-unquote globalization and the sort of desire to help people in our global community. That tends to die when the EU fractures and when people become less EU-centered. And so there is not so much in the EU itself, but in the political ideologies which manifest themselves. What ideology, what principles, what viewpoint is foremost in Europe?
And, of course, the ideology and the shifting political climate affects the way people all over Europe, as well as the UK, look at migrants, right? And there are many migrants from Africa in the UK. I wonder how this is going to affect present and future migrants.
If you have an EU, you have on the top people who are more global and therefore more willing to bring in migrants. They understand that in almost every European nation, birth rates are falling, so they need migrants. Migrants are good for the economy, and so just a question of how to manage it. The other philosophy is just that we are, excuse my blunt language, we are white Judeo-Christians and we don't want colored non-Christian people coming to mix with our society. And in my view, part of the revolt against the EU has to do with this debate. You know, there's a faction that just doesn't like globalization.
On a more macro level of scale, I understand you feel optimistic in some ways on what could happen post-Brexit between the economies of Africa and its relationship with both the EU and the UK.
One of the problems African nations are facing is that they are small and the outside blocs are large, be it China, European Union, the United States. Brexit may cause the EU to be smaller and Britain to be a standalone entity. You take SADC, for example. SADC is a regional bloc of South African nations, and they're looking for trade deals, okay? And now that there are two competing forces, the UK on the one side, post-Brexit, and the EU, now SADC can say, well, you better give me this, because if you don't give me this, these guys are going to give me that. And that's good for Africa. And we forget that there are a lot of trade restrictions in Europe, okay? The Common Agricultural Policy cap, for example, is harming African farmers. So to the extent you can get the UK and the EU fighting against each other, can get a better deal for our farmers, for our smallholder farmers. In that sense, hooray, Brexit is actually good for Africa. The other hand comes back to the political forces. One of the good things about having a large EU is that there's a certain culture that understands that we are on one planet and what happens in one place affects the others. And getting poorer nations to be richer is good for everybody. Brexit, anti-EU forces are, we don't care about the others. Let's solve our own internal problems first. We got Brexit now, and we don't give a damn about anybody else. We're going to protect our own farmers and our own industrialists and our own high-tech industries. We don't need those guys in Africa. Cut them off. And my point is that that's bad for Africa and could hurt the EU itself.
You don't feel good about all this?
No. I would have preferred it if the UK and the EU could find a way to patch their differences and stay into one larger group. I think it's better for humankind. Anytime you have these kind of divisions, that's how war starts, right? Things like trade issues, which can spark something. All of us have to be careful. We live on a very fragile planet, and so we need to think about ourselves as one global community.
Yao Nyako is an economics professor at New York University. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Kenya's authorities have begun a mass vaccination of girls against the human papilloma virus, HPV, which causes cervical cancer. According to the World Health Organization, the East African region has the highest rate of cervical cancer in the world. While Kenya usually leads the region on medical matters, officials admit they have been slow to protect girls and women against HPV. Ryle Ombor reports from Nairobi.
Kenya officially launched its HPV vaccination program Friday in the coastal town of Mombasa. The vaccine will be administered free to all 10-year-old girls as part of the country's routine immunization schedule. Girls will get the vaccine in two doses, 6 months apart. President Uhuru Kenyatta termed the vaccine rollout a major milestone in the fight against non-communicable diseases.
Access to the HPV vaccine by our girls will lead to a reduction in the number of new cervical cancer cases and secure the lives of our daughters and our sisters. This means that our young women, who are critical to the future of our nation, will be protected from early deaths.
Kenya's Ministry of Health says the vaccinations will cost about $7.7 million this year. Dr. Collins Tabu, head of the National Vaccine Immunization Program in Kenya, touted the benefits of the program in a talk with reporters.
So the introduction of HPV vaccine within our setup has potential to cut back the burden of cervical cancer by close to 70% if we achieve a good enough coverage of about 80%.
He said at least 7 women die every day through cervical cancer in Kenya.
The human papilloma virus, the most common sexually transmitted disease, with a prevalence of close to 50% within our borders, is responsible as the primary cause of more than 99% of all of the cervical cancers. There's a direct link, as we know today.
At least 115 other countries routinely administer the vaccine, including Uganda, Tanzania, and Rwanda. Tabu said because of the vaccine, Rwanda has nearly eliminated cervical cancer. Kenya has moved more slowly, possibly because of debates around the safety of vaccines. Earlier this decade, the Catholic Church in Kenya called for a boycott of a polio vaccine drive.
It's a bit embarrassing that Kenya may be the last or second last East African country to introduce the vaccine that is supposed to protect our girls against cervical cancer. Is it something we should then continue discussing about and holding back? Is something we need to think about. Is the whole world wrong? Is it something we need more evidence, even when we're seeing the burden of cervical cancer going down in these countries?
During Friday's launch, President Kenyatta dismissed claims the HPV vaccine might be unsafe, telling the crowd, "Let us not fight science." Ryle Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Mpuga in Washington. And at 19 minutes past the hour, here is a recap of our top stories. Botswana is preparing for elections next Wednesday as Mozambique continues to count ballots from its voting. We look at the fallout in Africa from Britain's exit from the EU, and Kenya is vaccinating girls for protection from a virus that can cause cervical cancer. And for more news and information, visit our website at voafrica.com. Zimbabwe's government proposed a media reform law in August, but stakeholders are up in arms over its provisions and the impact they would have on the Zimbabwean Media Commission and media outlets. Ade Gonda gives us more on the story.
As a group of legislators tours the country to get feedback on the bill, journalists and citizens are resoundingly expressing unhappiness with it, saying it seeks to entrench repressive statutory regulation of the media landscape. Observers say that contrary to the government's 2018 pledge to reform the media landscape and widen the playing field, the bill falls far short of expectations. It is designed to complement the Freedom of Information Act, which is still in draft and has also been widely deemed as unsatisfactory as repeal of legislation enacted in 2002. At a public hearings in Bulawayo, critics of the reform bill say none of the key recommendations by civil society and media freedom activists have been incorporated by the Ministry of Information, Media and Broadcasting Services. Those include decriminalization of the media profession, recognition of media self-regulation, and removal of political interference. Journalist Innocent Kurwa pointed to a section which gives the media minister powers to appoint commissioners.
The minister must be removed totally from involvement in the ZMC Act or bill. The ZMC must report to Parliament and be answerable public.
Journalism student Nobesu Tungwenya agrees.
Because the ministers of Zimbabwe are not usually appointed on merit. They are usually appointed on political affiliation. So the minister is not speaking on my behalf. I would like to suggest that parliamentarians, the executive powers should just dwell on the parliament as the parliament are representing the citizens and not the personal interests.
Legal experts say the widely defined roles of the minister running and managing the ZMC are contrary to the Constitution, which guarantees the independence of Chapter 12 institutions, such as the Zimbabwe Media Commission. Chris Mike, a media law expert, says that under the current wording, the Commission cannot make substantive decisions without consulting and seeking approval from the Minister.
The interference with the independence of the Media Commission. The Zimbabwe Media Commission is one of the Chapter 12 institutions that are established in the Constitution. That means that there are wide powers that are given to the Minister of Information, Publicity and Broadcasting Services to interfere basically with the operations of the Commission.
The Voluntary Media Council of Zimbabwe, a professional media self-regulatory body set up in 2007 by journalists and other stakeholders, has also come out against a section of the bill. The executive director of the organization, Lofty Dube, says it would renew repressive provisions of notorious IPA law, which critics say the government seeks to repeal just to look progressive but omits the cabinet-approved principle of co-regulation.
The issue of co-regulation, where people have been calling for a fusing together of statutory regulation and self-regulation as a way that might work for media regulation. The issue of decriminalizing the media. Remember, the bill wanted to continue with the criminalization of the profession through provisions that would make anyone who violates the rules of the commission to be liable to be jailed. People are speaking out against this criminalization of the profession, and we're very happy about that.
The bill calls for offenses and contraventions of regulations to be punishable by fines and sentences of up to 6 months. Critics say that it's a clear attempt to revive the criminal defamation offense that was struck down by the Constitutional Court in 2016. Reporting for VOA in Bulawayo, this is Adi Gondo.
Mosibudi Joe Mathole and Komoso Ramodipa are rare gems in the male-dominated diamond industry. The South African sisters run one of the few women-owned diamond polishing businesses in the world. And despite the slumping global market for diamonds and the shrinking industry in South Africa, they have managed to keep shining and developing new female talent. Marise de Klerk reports from Bedford View, South Africa.
Beautiful. A passion for diamonds drove South African sisters Mosibudi Joe Mathole and Khumotso Ramodipa to drop their careers as an investment banker and an optometrist. After qualifying as diamond valuators in 2008, they started a cutting and polishing shop, Kwame Diamonds, the first and only one run by sisters in South Africa. Entering this industry is not easy, explains the company's founder and director, Mosibudi Joe Mathole.
Barriers to entry go beyond just being a woman or being a man, because the difficulty, it boils down to having an outfit like this, you really need a proper capital outlay. And for women, it becomes a bit tricky because this has always been a very male-dominated industry.
But seeing challenges as opportunities, the sisters cut their way into the diamond industry, selling only responsibly sourced certified stones bought from mining companies operating in South Africa. Kwame Diamonds carved out a niche in cutting and polishing fancy and bespoke cut diamonds. They are also accredited to cut and polish the world-renowned De Beers Group's branded diamonds, says co-owner and director Komotso Ramodipa.
To produce a Forever Mark diamond, which according to them, it's 1% of the world diamonds that are produced. If you are able to polish that kind of diamond, then you are among one of the best.
Toli and Ramodipa employ and empower women in the diamond industry by developing their skills. Diamond polisher Grace Tsekhu's repertoire now includes more than the round cut.
Now I can go out there and say, I'm a diamond cutter. I'm even specializing with fancy cut. It's something that it's so wow, because other people, they don't know it.
Globally, polished diamonds' profit margins are declining. The South African industry shrank from 4,500 polishers 25 years ago to only 250 polishers today. But the sister-run Kwame Diamonds has managed to not only stay in the market, but gain a reputation for innovation, according to the president of the World Federation of Diamond Bursars, Ernie Blom.
They're looking at the diamond industry from a different perspective. They're thinking out of the box. And maybe they're ticking all the right boxes that is giving them the success that they have. And maybe that's what a lot of the older diamond industry can learn from.
Many in South Africa's diamond industry fear a lack of growth will cause a shortage of jobs for trained diamond talent. Matoli disagrees.
How you approach the business is what will set you apart. So yes, it is shrinking, but we are here not to shrink. We are here to make sure that we expand.
These dynamic sisters are determined to prove not just that diamonds are girls' best friend, but that the industry is a place where women can shine. Marise de Klerk for VOA News, Bedford View, South Africa.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impunga in Washington. For all latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Daniel Brown, and our engineer, Nick Ivanovic, thank you for choosing The Voice of America.
Escape from the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of The Voice of America's African Beat. Splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical journey. I guarantee it.
African Beats.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory reports its heat flow and physical properties package, one of three primary instruments on its Mars InSight lander, is moving again. Nicknamed the Mole, the heat probe is supposed to burrow itself into the surface of Mars to take its internal temperature. The Mole was designed to dig as much as 16 meters into the interior of Mars, but in early March 2019, after digging to a depth of about 35 centimeters, it hit rocks and stopped working. To get the Mole moving again, operators of the InSight lander used its robotic arm to help it dig nearly 2 centimeters over the past week.